So please give a warm welcome to Reverend Burens.
Ann was gracious enough to pick me up at the BART station and get me here this morning. It was a bit of a schlep over from the city with the work being done in Oakland on the BART line, but I'm delighted to be here and to kick off your personal theology series. I think those of us who are concerned today about climate change, about human rights, about the way in which our government is going, need the spiritual refreshment of returning to our forebears, the Transcendentalists. The book that I've just finished writing, which won't be out for almost a year, takes a long time to go through the publication process, is one of the most exciting things I've ever worked on. I was partly inspired to do it by reading a profile in the New Yorker some years ago. I don't know how many of you ever saw the wonderful film Boyhood by Richard Linklater. I commend it to you, if only on Netflix. It's recently been listed as one of the 20 best American films since the year 2000. Well, Linklater, in his profile in the New Yorker, said, and I think this is almost a direct quote, "Of course, the movie I've always wanted to make is about the Transcendentalists, because they changed American life. They helped launch abolitionism, the women's suffrage movement, the concern for the natural environment. But I've been working on it for 15 years and I can't come up with a screenplay that doesn't have too many scenes set in parlors with people doing high-minded talk. And that doesn't make a movie." This is literally in the introduction to my book with the bald opening of the next paragraph, "Maybe this book will help." Because what I have attempted to do is to break through some of the stereotypes about our Transcendentalist forebears, for which I blame too many English teachers. Well, it's not their personal fault. It's that that's the context in which most of us get exposed to American Transcendentalism, in high school or college English courses, where we read, at best, a little Emerson, some Thoreau. Walden, you know, is now the most widely read American book from before the Civil War. And maybe, if there's a bit of a feminist consciousness in the classroom, Margaret Fuller gets at least a brief mention, if not an excerpt from her pioneering book, Woman in the 19th Century. Well, I'm afraid that what happens as a result is that people come away with a sense that, first of all, Transcendentalism is centered in the lovely rural town of Concord, Massachusetts, that it revolves around Mr. Emerson, and that it is primarily made up of people who are somewhat individualistic, intellectual, disaffiliates. Emerson left the ministry, famously. Thoreau quit the church. And a bit distant, transcendent. The historical facts, the things that most people don't know about American Transcendentalists, are the following. They were, almost to a person, Unitarian church people, deeply devoted to congregational life, not disaffiliates. Secondly, they were mostly centered in Boston. not in Concord. Almost all of the significant meetings and events that constitute the upsurge of the Transcendentalist movement take place in downtown Boston. Concord's a better place to visit if you want to go on a literary pilgrimage. The Emerson House is still there. Walden Pond is now the most visited state park in Massachusetts, and you can be led to the footings of Thoreau's cabin. The Author's Ridge in Sleepy Hollow Cemetery guards the bones of Hawthorne, Thoreau, Emerson, the Alcotts. It makes for a lovely literary pilgrimage. But when I lead people in the Boston area to learn the history associated with American Transcendentalism, I start at number 13 West Street, half a block off the Boston Common, a building that in recent years is just a shell of an early 19th century townhouse. It's been a series of bad restaurants. But it's got a plaque on the side that identifies it as the site of Elizabeth Peabody's bookstore. I'm going to talk next week more about Peabody and Fuller and a series of more forgotten female transcendentalists. But that was the real center of the Transcendentalist movement. That's where they came to get the latest philosophical and literary outpourings of Europe, because Elizabeth was fluent in French and German and knew some Italian and brought in books, particularly the German idealists, who are the intellectual font of American Transcendentalism. And I'll say a little bit more about that in a minute. But that's the real center that I think gets forgotten. Another thing that is forgotten about the Transcendentalists is just how deeply engaged they were as social activists. Far from being, like Emerson, inclined in his famous essay on self-reliance to say, "Are they my poor?" Another one of his remarks that I always find very distancing is in his essay on friendship, saying, "Most men descend to meet." Far from being that aloof, the bulk of the Transcendentalists were practitioners of spiritual friendship in the interest of pursuing a culture with greater respect and dignity for everybody's human rights. If you want a practical definition of their ideals, it was grounded in a version of Kant's imperative. In essence, they felt that I have a vested interest, an imperative, to see to your full development and flourishing as a moral and spiritual being. Because only if I invest in your full flourishing will you help create a friendship circle and ultimately a culture in which you too care about my full flourishing as a spiritual and moral being. Now, if that isn't the ground of contemporary humanitarian thinking, human rights thinking, Unitarian Universalism, I don't know what is. But we forget where it comes from in the history of our country, and we forget how powerfully connected these people were in friendships that, among other things, remarkably transcended the usual categories that separated people. They transcended gender. they transcended social location and economic privilege. They transcended gaps between the clergy and the laity. They transcended, remarkably, even race. Though that was hardly common in that era. I'll give you a few illustrations. Peabody took the position that the real founder of American Transcendentalism was not Emerson. It was William Ellery Channing, the spiritual founder of Unitarianism, who introduced her to Samuel Taylor Coleridge's Aids to Reflection and his Biographia Literaria, both of which drew on German idealism and introduced the concept of the transcendental, which goes back to Kant. Kant challenged the empiricist notion that everything we know comes in through our five senses and is written on a blank slate. That was the common philosophy of the 18th century. But Kant said, I think there are certain transcendent categories, ruling ideas that are almost wired in, that help us sort out the good from the bad, the finite from the infinite. These transcendent categories get interpreted variously by Kant's disciples, and both in Germany and in England, people like Thomas Carlyle, another powerful influence. But people were reading these folks considerably before the transcendentalist circle ever came together. And one of the stories that I think is forgotten is, when does the original transcendentalist club or circle actually form? I came from my Harvard College 50th reunion this May. The transcendentalists gathered for the Harvard College bicentennial in 1836 because they were disgusted with their alma mater. They felt that the education they had received there was backward-looking and useless. It was a time when it was almost entirely tied up in Greek and Latin classics and mathematics, and the smattering of natural history. Nothing about contemporary issues, the present, much less aspirations for the common future. And a quartet of four Unitarian minister graduates of Harvard came together right after having listened to all of the backward-looking celebration of 200 years of Harvard history and said, we got to get together. Having read some of the German idealists and the English interpreters of German idealism, we've got to get together and see if we can't bring both the culture in our congregations and in education in America, into the present, and more capable of shaping the common future. Those four, now largely forgotten, were George Ripley, who later becomes the founder of that experiment in communal living called Brook Farm, and Ralph Waldo Emerson, and Frederick Henry Hedge, another Unitarian minister who's almost entirely forgotten, although in our hymnal you'll find a couple of hymns that he wrote, including the standard American or English translation of Luther's hymn, Ein feste Burg, a mighty fortress. Because Hedge was one of the relatively few Americans who had actually gone to Germany and earned a doctorate there. His father, Levi Hedge, was the professor of philosophy at Harvard and taught the empiricist, common sense, what his son called materialist notion of human knowledge. Hedge came back powerfully convinced that Kant was on the right track, that there were certain ethical imperatives that were wired in, if we paid attention, that transcended the material, and that American religious and spiritual and moral life needed to be brought into line with this more contemporary and idealistic thinking. George Putnam, the minister of the church in Roxbury, was also present for that gathering. And now I'm going to block on who the fourth one was. Never mind. Okay. Yeah, Hedge, Ripley, Emerson, and Putnam. That's it. Well, they agreed that they would start meeting periodically. One of the things that's difficult to understand about the Transcendentalists is that there's no fixed membership. It's kind of like this gathering, right? People showed up for meetings depending on the relevance to them of the topic. There was no secretary, no chair. People were free to invite friends who might contribute to the conversation. The group was never large. It was never this large. The average attendance at the Transcendentalist Circle meeting was 11. They met in people's homes. By the second year, one of the youngest ministerial members, James Freeman Clark, who came all the way back to Boston every August and September from his pastorate in Louisville, Kentucky, to be with his Transcendentalist friends. He was including people like Elizabeth Peabody and Margaret Fuller in the discussions, so that the group, which started out almost all male, or started out all male and almost all ministers, had broadened. Emerson brought in Bronson Alcott, radical educator, leader of the Temple School. I suppose that's another area that sometimes gets mentioned, the Alcott family. Bronson was not capable of earning a living, but it wasn't because he was stupid. It was because he was so far ahead of his time that he could not could not fit in all that easily as an educator. His great tragedy, in many respects, the failure of the Temple School, had to do with his doing conversations with children about the Gospels in an almost Socratic fashion. And if the kids asked about concepts like virgin birth or circumcision, Bronson gave them candid, if somewhat guarded, I think age-appropriate answers. But that shocked people. And it shut down the school, in which Elizabeth Peabody was his assistant, followed by Margaret Fuller. Now, I introduced this concept of spiritual friendship. It's terribly important to understanding how the Transcendentalists really functioned. It's well known that they were great journal keepers. Almost everybody who came into contact with Emerson, for example, whether it was Elizabeth Peabody or Thoreau, was encouraged to keep a daily journal. Mine's in my briefcase. I think that actually paying attention to one's own deepest reflection and thinking is quite important. But do you know that it was common practice to then share your journal with a friend? people would read their journals to one another and around the parlor in the evening. Or, in the case of the friendship between Margaret Fuller and James Freeman Clark, she would write to him and say, "Send me your journal for the last 6 months. I want to know what you've been thinking." Their friendship is the one that really got me going on this book. Because although they figured out very early on that they were not going to be husband and wife, the depth of their affection and commitment to one another was lifelong. It began in an almost romantic way at the age of 20, when Clark was a student at Harvard and Margaret was this remarkably self-educated young woman who lived in Cambridge. Her father, by the way, was a congressman and an attorney. He, I think, had been disappointed that his firstborn child was not a boy. And he gave Margaret the kind of education that would have prepared her to go to Harvard. So he once wrote home to her mother when she was four, "Tell little Margaret I love her if she learns her Latin." By six, she could recite Virgil. She mastered all of the classics and taught herself French and German. Well, she and Clark were studying Goethe together at age 20. And she had such a powerful effect on him that he went back to his dorm room and wrote in his journal what I think of as a verbatim account of the conversation. We used to do these things in clinical pastoral education, learning to be chaplains in the hospital, verbatim interaction with the patient lying in the bed. Had to be reported to the supervisors. The journal that is probably my only important archival discovery in this book begins with, "Jay, I hesitate to come to you when I have no fresh ideas to share. M. What makes you think I'm interested in your ideas?" Margaret was an intimidating woman. But when Clark got to Louisville, Kentucky, he literally launched the first Transcendentalist journal before the dial existed. It's called the Western Messenger. And in it, he published some of Margaret Fuller's first essays. He kept encouraging her to become a writer. She, on the other hand, kept encouraging him to become a better preacher. Occasionally, she drafted a sermon and sent it to him. She heard him preach his trial sermon and encouraged him in his chosen vocation. Clark came back to Boston in 1841 at a particularly pregnant moment in Boston intellectual, spiritual, moral, religious life. William Ellery Channing had essentially resigned from the ministry, or at least from preaching, after his congregation just broke his heart. Here was the background to that. He had formed a close spiritual friendship with Carl Christian Theodor Friedrich Fallen. Charles Fallen, born in Germany, very much raised in German idealism. Fallen had come to America because he was, well, chased out of Germany for being too radical, and ended up being the first professor of German at Harvard. Also teaching gymnastics, introducing that whole discipline to America. Opened the first public gymnasium in downtown Boston. Taught the young men at Harvard how to do their exercises and so forth. Very popular teacher, but he lost his teaching position because he was an abolitionist. And in mid-1830 Boston, to be an abolitionist was to stand in the way of commerce. The New England cotton mills were opening. The Boston bankers were making their fortunes in the cotton trade and in the textile mills. And to call for the immediate abolition of slavery was to be regarded as a radical who was too dangerous to have in a university position. Channing was already beginning to die of the tuberculosis, which was endemic at the time, and felt both too ill to attend meetings of the Anti-Slavery Society and too concerned about their intemperate and almost counterproductive forms of rhetoric to do anything about it himself. But he designated Charles Follin to represent him there. And he mentored Follin into the Unitarian ministry and presided at his ordination at the Federal Street Church. In 1840, in mid-January, Follin was coming back from giving a series of lectures in New York City at the church that Channing himself had helped to found around his sister's family. And the church is now called the Unitarian Church of All Souls, which I served as co-minister in the 1980s. Follin was coming back on the steamer Lexington when he noticed that the deckhands had stacked bales of cotton for the textile mills right next to the smokestack. There was a substitute captain aboard who hadn't been warned that when they changed the boiler in this steamboat, sidewheeler, from wood burning to coal burning, it had a terrible tendency to overheat the stack. And let's just cut to the chase. The cotton caught fire. The ship burned. My book opens with a chapter entitled Conflagration, in which an abolitionist minister tragically dies at sea amid burning bales of cotton. This was William Ellery Channing's dear friend, Charles Follin. His congregation, typical of that era, was governed not by a more democratic vote of all those who attended. It was governed by trustees elected only by those who owned pews in the Federal Street Church. They were the State Street bankers and the people behind the textile mills. They denied Channing the right to hold a memorial service for his dearest friend who had been ordained in that church. Channing's reaction, this is a story that's rarely told, was one of just heartbrokenness. But he was so temperate in his concern not to break relations with people that he simply wrote the trustees and told them that he would accept no more salary It's almost as though he said, I'll take no more of your filthy money. And I'd like to be relieved of all of my duties of public ministry. He was already turning over much of the preaching to his associate because of his illness. Give the money to him. He essentially resigned in place. He told them that if they wanted him to dissolve the pastoral relationship, he would wish that it be immediate. But notice he didn't resign as their pastor. He was still alive. He still cared about them. It was as though he was saying, I still care about your souls, even though you've sold them. And he maintained friendship with as many people as he could. When Clark came back from Louisville, he organized a congregation made up of people like Elizabeth Peabody, who had been among Channing's closest friends and disciples, both of Channing's brothers who lived in Boston, his brother Walter, who was the first dean of Harvard Medical School, and his brother George, who later became a minister. And this first transcendentalist church, called the Church of the Disciples, is now largely forgotten. But it was organized at 13 West Street in Elizabeth Peabody's home, where earlier Margaret Fuller had begun her historic Conversations for Women. And within a couple of years, it's where Clark presided at the wedding of Sophia Peabody, Elizabeth's youngest sister, to Nathaniel Hawthorne. And where he presided at the wedding of Mary Peabody to Horace Mann, the great pioneer in starting universal free public education. You see why that is a landmark site? And why it is the real center of transcendentalism? Clark's congregation was never huge. It had its own internal dispute within a couple of years over whether he should include as a guest preacher the even more radical transcendentalist Theodore Parker. Now, I don't know how much you know about Parker, but you should know at least this. There are two phrases that we associate with others in American life that really go back to him. During President Obama's administration, they were included around the oval rug in the Oval Office. The famous statement, "The moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends toward justice." We, of course, associate that with Dr. King. But Dr. King picked it up when he and Coretta were attending the Arlington Street Church, the successor to the Federal Street Church in Boston, and listening to Dana Greeley preach and quote Theodore Parker. The other statement is government of the people, by the people, for the people. Famously used, of course, at the very end of Lincoln's immortal Gettysburg Address. But it too goes back to Theodore Parker as a preacher, whose sermons were often printed and sent to people like William Herndon, the Unitarian lawyer who was Abraham Lincoln's law partner in Springfield, Illinois. See, these are some of the things that many people don't know that they don't know about American transcendentalism. Nor do they know just how radical people like Parker could be. among other things, he was one of the leaders of the Anti-Slavery Society who formed a vigilance committee to try to protect fugitive slaves after the passage of the notorious Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, for which Emerson wrote, "This filthy enactment was penned by human beings in the 19th century. You can read and write. I will not obey it, by God." And Parker wrote his sermons with a loaded pistol on his gun, on his desk, because he often had fugitive slaves in his home. And he was afraid federal marshals might break in and try to capture one of his congregants. In 1854, during the attempt to rescue a fugitive slave who had been captured by the marshals and was being held in the courthouse, one Anthony Burns, Parker preached such a fiery statement to the crowd at Faneuil Hall that was protesting that he was later indicted for incitement to riot. But the prosecutors gave up when they couldn't get a jury to sit in judgment on him. In the course of that riot, Lewis Hayden, Boston's leading black abolitionist, who had been befriended by one of the leading members of Clark's congregation, John Andrew, who later became the Civil War governor of Massachusetts. Lewis Hayden worked with Thomas Wentworth Higginson, another Unitarian Transcendentalist minister, and literally took a great beam and beat in the courthouse door to try to rescue Burns. It didn't work. Tragically, it failed. A few days later, they watched a whole contingent of Marines and guardsmen escort Burns down to the wharf to be taken south back to slavery in Virginia. But it radicalized Boston. Even Abbot Lawrence, one of the textile mill owners, a so-called cotton wig, wrote in his journal, "We went to bed conservative cotton wigs. We woke up radical abolitionists." This was the kind of transformative and courageous work that our Transcendentalist forebearers were doing, not just high-minded conversation in parlors. But dramatic episodes like that, or the death of Fallon, or the tragic death of Margaret Fuller, returning from covering the revolutions in Europe in the 1848-49 period. You know, she and her husband and her child were lost at sea when their ship foundered at Fire Island, New York. Say a little bit more about that next week. These episodes tend to be forgotten. So does the connection between what I have come to realize was the high watermark of the influence of American Unitarianism in all of American history. And that was during the Civil War. The Vice President of the United States was a Unitarian. 16 members of the Senate were Unitarians. The largest humanitarian exercise to that date in American history, the so-called Sanitary Commission, which later became the essentially the Red Cross, was all organized by Unitarians, including our own Thomas Starr King, who was its greatest fundraiser. So the influence of Transcendentalism came to the West Coast by that point. Probably should throw in toward the end of my book, I mention how some of the Transcendentalist heritage gets passed on to succeeding generations. My great scenes is that of Emerson coming out here to lecture. I'm still digging around in archives in San Francisco trying to get records of the 6 lectures he gave at the church in San Francisco. But he went up to Yosemite and spent an entire day with John Muir. And Muir later wrote in his own journal just a marvelous account of leaving Emerson at the Mariposa Grove, and Emerson hanging back as people went off on these pack horses and turning around and waving at Muir in benediction, and then telling friends in the party later that he thought that Muir was possibly an even greater naturalist than his friend Thoreau had been. It's no accident, of course, that the Sierra Club motto, "In wildness is the preservation of the world," is Muir's quotation from Thoreau. Well, I could go on and on with what I've learned about what I didn't know about the Transcendentalists and their impact on American life and culture. But I hope that this has given you at least a few places where you'll want to leap in and ask me a little bit more, because believe me, there's plenty more. Good place to stop and invite your questions, responses.
Okay, is this working? Yes, it is. Okay, any questions? We'll move the mic around to each person so that all can hear the question.
Hi, thank you so much. Two things. One, wasn't the quotation from Theodore Parker, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice"? You'd said the moral arc of the universe, so I just thought I'd mention that. Picky.
I was just going over my publisher's guidelines, and they do big emphasis on accuracy of quotation.
Okay. And I also noticed that my understanding was that Abraham Lincoln had pamphlets of Theodore Parker's speeches on his bedside table. So when he would have really had that in mind when he wrote the Declaration of Independence.
He also periodically went to hear the Unitarian minister who was then preaching in Washington, D.C. You'll love this. The Unitarian Sunday morning services were held in the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol.
Oh, wow. Oh, my God. Well, I think then we should also mention that one of my candidates, I know we have the Unitarian Hall of Fame. We also have the Unitarian Hall of Shame. And one of my star candidates for that is, you were mentioning the vice president being Unitarian, and I'm not sure who that was.
Hannibal Hamlin of Maine.
Oh, okay, good. Well, also we should mention that the vice president of the Confederacy was also a Unitarian.
Yeah, when he was in Washington. When he was in the South, he was an Episcopalian.
Oh. So we dodged that bullet. So I'm blocking on his name, but it was... Yeah. What's his name?
Well, I can't recall either. It's exactly the same pattern that John C. Calhoun... Well, he was not vice president of the Confederacy. No, he was vice president of the United States under Andrew Jackson. He wasn't alive by the time of the Civil War. Yeah. As I'm sure that's true. Go ahead.
No, we're trying. Yeah. Okay, Transcendentalist influence support for the Civil War.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's one of the very interesting transitions that you see going on in the 1850s. These people were idealists who were mostly pacifists by inclination, but they became more and more deeply convinced that slavery could not be ended by peaceful means. Mm-hmm. And the People like Garrison, who was the founder of the Anti-Slavery Society, was both a so-called Christian non-resistance advocate. That is, he was trying to reassure whites that the abolitionist movement was not in the business of stirring up slave insurrections, which was a big fear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, you know, the black abolitionists basically said, easy for you to say. So by the time you have the influence of people like Frederick Douglass, who never bought into non-resistance, never believed that the South would willingly give up their property, you also had things like simultaneous with the Anthony Burns event in Boston. In Washington, that same day, they passed the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which opened a huge tract of the American Plains to the possibility of popular sovereignty spreading slavery. And that, of course, leads to Bleeding Kansas. The prelude to the Civil War really takes place in Kansas, with armed ruffians coming in from Missouri to try to make it a slave state, even as New England emigrants who were abolitionists tried to settle there and make it a free state. John Brown began his radical abolitionist career in Kansas and was supported by people like Theodore Parker. The Secret Six, who funded and supported John Brown, were, in essence, all transcendentalists. The only one of them who wasn't a Unitarian was Gerrit Smith from upstate New York. He was more or less a universalist in his personal theology, but also very much influenced by transcendentalism. And the others were Theodore Parker, Thomas Wentworth Higginson, who was perhaps the most radical of them. Higginson, by the way, was the colonel of what was really the first African-American regiment in the Civil War, the first South Carolina Volunteers. The whole organization of the 54th Massachusetts Volunteers was a church project. This was an amazing... John Andrew, who commissioned the famous regiment that, you know, is remembered in the film Glory, and also selected young transcendentalist Robert Gould Shaw from a leading Unitarian family as the officer to lead them. He couldn't... these were supposed to be volunteers. That meant you came with your own kit. The northern freed African-Americans who volunteered, recruited by another one of the Secret Six, George Stearns, who was a member of Parker's congregation, and by Frederick Douglass, they were poor. They couldn't bring a musket and a pack and a uniform. So the Church of the Disciples raised the money for them to outfit them. Amazing stuff. Well...
No, it's okay. Yeah, I was just saying, it's similar today. You have the peace activists, but then they feel like they need to use violence to promote change in the culture.
No.
And it seems to be a vein there between among the old 1800s thinking and today. I mean, there's a connection.
Yeah. Here's another example. The composition of the Battle Hymn of the Republic by Julia Ward Howe took place in the following way. Her husband, Samuel Gridley Howe, the director of the Perkins School for the Blind, was one of the commissioners for the U.S. Sanitary Commission, which was chaired by Henry Whitney Bellows, the Unitarian minister in New York. Sam was going down to Washington to inspect the Union camps around the city for their sanitary conditions. And so many people were dying of disease. more than from bullets, that it was part of the real horror of that war, which cost America a larger percentage of its population. And if we today suffered the same percentage loss of population that the Civil War brought about, there'd be 8 million Americans dead. So Drew Gilpin Faust, who just stepped down as president of Harvard, has written this marvelous book about the impact of the Civil War and its staggering levels of death on American culture. So anyway, Julia goes along on this trip with James Freeman Clark, her minister. And they go out to inspect some troops, see what the troops are doing, and find the men marching along singing "John Brown's Body Lies a-Moldering in the Grave." Well, this was a painful thing for Julia. Her husband had been one of the Secret Six that had funded John Brown. And she had been absolutely devastated with the thought that she was going to be left with her kids to raise and no husband, that he was going to be tried and hung for treason. He actually had to flee to Canada when John Brown was captured and hung. So her minister says to her, "That's clearly a tune that the men in uniform love. It's a pity it doesn't have better words." Julia went back to her hotel room, and with her baby lying next to her, got up in the middle of the night. And she was quite a gifted poet. Sat down and penned the words of the Battle Hymn of the Republic. But going back to your question about violence and pacifist ideals, you go into our hymnal and you won't find her battle hymn. What you'll find is her Mother's Day Proclamation for Peace, written in 1870. "Arise, women of the world." It's one of the things that I try to bring out in the book is actually some of the theological depth of these transcendentalist religious leaders in our own movement. They knew America had committed an original sin in slavery and that it needed to be redeemed. They helped Lincoln understand in his second inaugural that not until America had paid the price was it likely to find wholeness again. So they were reluctant users of violence, but always in the defense of human dignity and freedom. And then people like Julia go right back to saying, "Let's do everything we can to prevent war and to maintain justice through peaceful means." So it looks like a huge contradiction, but historically I think it was closer to theological realism. Sir?
Well, for me, Emerson's poem, Brahma, represents a thread of transcendentalism that is sometimes neglected,
yes,
and which goes all the way back at least to the Library of Alexandria in the ancient pre-Christian world. And so part of what I put forth is tracing that root, which still is active, of accepting the wisdom of religions outside of the Judeo-Christian circle and placing them on an equal footing with those that are within the Judeo-Christian circle.
The Transcendentalists were among the first Americans to read non-Western scriptures, the Vedas. Elizabeth Peabody actually translated the Lotus Sutra, not from the Sanskrit, but from an earlier French translation, and published it in the Dial. When Clark became ill in 1849-50 and went back to where his wife had been raised in Meadville, Pennsylvania, he taught at the Unitarian Seminary in Meadville, and the course that he offered was probably the first American academic course in comparative religion. After the Civil War, Clark returned to that theme and published a series of essays in the Atlantic on what were then referred to as ethnic religions, starting with Chinese philosophies, interestingly enough. And those turned into his being appointed the first professor of comparative religion anywhere at Harvard, and a part-time job, which he did along with leading what became Boston's largest Unitarian church. And also, he became one of the most influential Unitarian ministers in the country. If you go down to the Oakland church and see the six stained glass portraits in the vestibule, some of them you'll recognize. Channing's there. Thomas Starr King is there. The two founding ministers of the Oakland church are there. Henry Whitney Bellows is there because he came out here to sort of rescue Unitarianism when Starr King died. And the last person in that series is James Freeman Clark. He's the thread figure in my book, partly because of his remarkable work. His book, 10 Great Religions, went through 22 editions and stayed in print until the 1920s. For years, it was deeply out of fashion because it actually applied evolutionary thinking to the study of religion. And until the last couple of decades, thanks to people like Robert Bella at Cal Berkeley, a lot of anthropologists didn't want to think in evolutionary terms about some societies and religious traditions actually being more evolved, in a sense, than others. But Bella had the great insight that the structure and belief systems of religion are tremendously shaped by the size of the human community from which it emerges. So our early hunter-gatherer forebearers who traveled in packs of about 150, you all had shamans. And there's a whole level of American of religious tradition globally that is shamanistic in one form or another. When you get settled agricultural communities, you get there's a transcendence to more Bella uses the term archaic forms of religion. These are temple-centered, often emphasize sacrifice of the produce of the field and the flocks. And they center around temples and often kingship, because there are groups that are interacting with one another, and keeping the peace is a major issue. Archaic religion is transcended, again, in what's known as the Axial Age, that starts about 800 before the Common Era and ends about 250 years before the Common Era. And you see it in China, you see it in India, you see it in the emergence of Greek philosophy and humanism. So evolutionary thought is another dimension of the functioning of the transcendentalists. The first positive reception of Darwin's thinking in America comes through transcendentalist circles. There's a new book out which has a title that, you know, the book can't possibly live up to. One of the things you learn as an author is you can't even title your own book. You know, your publisher retains the right to change the title for marketing purposes. This is a book called The Book That Changed America. And it's about the reception of Darwin's Origin of the Species, which was published in 1859 and first reached America at Christmas that year and was discussed at a New Year's dinner party in Concord, hosted by another one of the Secret Six, the schoolmaster Franklin Sanborn, with Bronson Alcott and Henry David Thoreau in attendance. And there we go, the articles in The Atlantic and so forth. The first positive reception of evolutionary thinking comes in our transcendentalist circles. I should make my answer shorter.
So this was a follow-up to the your idea of the tabula rasa, or the clean slate, and transcendentalism being a transcendent, emergent phenomenon. And we're... Parker's comments like Arc of the Moral Universe and things like that, examples of this kind of emergent sense of what thinking or what minding is all about?
Yeah. One of the things I tried to avoid was... claiming that the transcendentalists were more philosophically uniform or coherent than they were. All that one can really say is that they tended to take John Locke's tabula rasa thinking, which they had all been raised in, as basically materialistic, and they connected it to the emphasis that their culture put on material things and success. They, on the other hand, felt, along with Immanuel Kant and many of his followers, that moral intuition, shaped by transcendent categories that go beyond sense data, moral intuition and spiritual intuition was far more important than the gathering up of data. Now, this reminds me of one of those Jungian polarities that, you know, in the Myers-Briggs scheme, you know, there's you can be an S or an I. S standing for sense data, I standing for intuitive. Most Unitarian Universalists, by the way, are I's. My wife was once interviewed by a committee where one of the members said, "Well, I'm a very strong S, and I don't think we have enough data about you." And her response was, "Well, I am an INTP, I guess it was, and or INFP, and I just feel certain, I can intuitively feel certain that I'm right here, ask me anything, you know?" So, I'm not about to say that one of these philosophies was right and the other one was wrong. No good contemporary student of epistemology would do the kind of bifurcation that was taking place in that era. But historically, there was a shift in philosophical thinking going on. And that, by the way, is as I've done the history of liberal religion in America, I've seen several major shifts in thinking. For our humanist manifesto allies in the 1920s were often sort of scientific positivists. But by the time of World War II, you have an emergence of existentialism. Bernie Loomer, who started this series, was strongly influenced by Whitehead and process thought, which has influenced me very deeply. These are all shifts in epistemology, in our whole theory of knowledge. And so one of them was going on in the era between, say, Hedge's father and himself. And that's very important to understanding who the transcendentalists thought they were. Anyone who was more inclined away from the sense theory of knowledge and toward this more intuitive moral approach was one of the like-minded. James Freeman Clark said of the transcendentalists, though, "We considered ourselves like-minded because no two of us thought alike." Does that sound familiar? One more.
Hello. Yes. I want to say thank you. This has been just fascinating. It's foundational. It's inspiring. I can't wait to read your book, but I know I'm going to have to wait.
Yeah.
And I realize I have a really kind of starter question.
Sure.
And it's interesting because my father, Richard Bridgman, professor at UC Berkeley, has written all the books on the Transcendentalists, which I haven't read since, you know, many, many, many years. So my foundational question is, were Transcendentalists, the name they chose, Transcendental, were they transcendentaling Unitarians or Universalists? Who were they transcendentaling?
To a person, they were Unitarians. The best way to understand the origins of the Transcendentalist movement is that it was a spiritual moral revival movement within Unitarianism.
And they were transcending the...
So, among other things, they believed that the very nature of existence embodied a kind of yearning in all things for self-transcendence. This is why they were so open to evolution. Our own self-transcendence is a yearning for to become our best selves, to become more authentic, more compassionate, more effective. All of those values are deeply grounded in what they understood with the term. But it really, Emerson gave a lecture in 1841 at the Melodeon in Boston called The Transcendentalist. And he began by saying, "Transcendentalism is idealism as it appears in 1841. This doesn't help much. I include one of the better definitions of transcendentalism, which I'll use next week at your suggestion, because it comes from one of the most important but forgotten female transcendentalists. I'm only going to talk about the forgotten women next week, because they're so fascinating. And this is Lydia Maria Child. The only thing most people remember about Lydia Maria Child is that she penned that wonderful little ditty, "Over the river and through the woods, to grandfather's house we go." The Thanksgiving song. But she was the editor of the Anti-Slavery Standard, the author of a three-volume remarkable book in the 1840s, on the progress of religious ideas through the ages. The author of a two-volume study of the condition of women in various historical and cultural periods. Stunning in her depth and insight. By the way, her brother, Converse Francis, Unitarian minister in Watertown, was the senior person present at the first major meeting of the Transcendentalists and was chosen as the moderator of the group. So, on to next week. I look forward to dialoguing with you some more. We'll talk individually. Let me add just one last thing, because your question prompts me to remember this. Most histories of the Transcendentalists are literary histories. They are not engaged in the full understanding of the movement in its political, social, moral activism. So a lot of the books about transcendentalism just emphasize the literary production.